The Red Sox in Boston and the White Sox host the Tampa Bay Rays. Now looking at the forecast details from the National Weather Service. Today, we'll see variable cloudiness throughout the day. And then the National Weather Service says rainy, windy conditions move in late in the afternoon. Today's high heading for 59. Normal high this time of year is 59. And later on, we'll see winds 15 to 30 miles per hour. Tonight, then, sunset 7:47. Rainy, windy, and mild. Tonight's low 51. The weekend looks half and half. Saturday, cloudy, windy, and warm. A high of 79. Winds up to 25 miles per hour. But then Sunday, cloudy, windy, warm, and again, rainy. Sunday's high 73, cooler near Lake Michigan. Winds up to 25 miles per hour. Pretty good start to the morning. 45 degrees Kenosha, 44 in Racine, 43 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind is from the southeast at 13. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 11 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be spending just about all of the hour today talking about an exciting event that is happening tomorrow in Racine. It is an open house for the 16th Street Art Studios. And the 16th Street Studio certainly are an important part of the artistic landscape of the city of Racine, but it also might be something that that some people are not yet aware of. And so this open house is a way to step into what amounts to kind of the artistic home for some 90 Racine and Racine area artists of various kinds. And three people who are part of these 16th Street Art Studios are joining us in the studios of WGTD today. First of all, I'm really happy to have Margaret Heller here. She is a fiber artist and quilt artist with a studio there on 16th Street. And it was Margaret's idea to have this conversation today. And she helped organize this to include two of her colleagues, Robert Mayer, who is a ceramics artist, and he's also the primary organizer of this open house happening tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken. And then finally, Joseph Vigneri, whom I've known quite a long time for all of the great performances that he delivered at the Racine Theater Guild. He has a live model studio at the 16th Street Studios. And so we're going to be talking with each of them about their own artistic endeavors and about what people can expect if they make themselves a part of the open house, which is happening tomorrow. So Margaret Heller, Robert Mayer, Joseph Vigneri, we welcome all three of you to the morning show today.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah, glad we can be doing this. Margaret, you had mentioned when you reached out to me initially that this is actually by no means the first open house that has occurred at the 16th Street Studios. Tell us about previous open houses that have occurred.
Well, I'm just going to mention that I've been a part of three of them because I started renting a studio there in October of 2022. And so we usually have the first first Saturday of December and the last Saturday of April every year, a spring and a Christmas open house. And I look forward to it because, you know, we're working in there. We're locked up. You can't walk around. You can't go visit the artists until those open houses. But I'm going to let Joseph and Robert talk about the history of it because they've been a part of the 16th Street Studios for a long time.
Great. Okay. Let's start with Robert since he is the also the primary organizer of tomorrow's open house. But let's first get a little historical context here in terms of when the 16th Street Studios first opened for business.
I think we're now at the 28th open house. It's been going on for quite a while, and the community support has been really incredible, and it gets better every year. One thing I do want to just kind of plug a little bit is the street address is 1405 16th Street. It's a wonderful building, just shy of 600,000 square feet, originally built. It's really a testament to Racine and the surrounding area's industrial history because the building was basically started to go ahead and provide an industry and commerce for manufacturing of all sorts of things. And the one thing that people should really check out when they come by is on the second floor is the Spirit of Racine's Museum, which really highlights all of the different manufacturing that was going on going back to the mid-19th century. So it's a wonderful spot to go ahead and really see the kinds of things that were being produced in that building.
Hmm. What can you tell us about the creation of this, and have you been a part of it essentially from the very beginning?
I started, about 6 years ago I came on board, and there's been a small group of individuals that basically started this to showcase their own work. And it grew from there. The one thing that we want to talk about also is the fact that there's merchants within the building. So you're not only going to see, when you visit studios, you're not only going to see some just incredible world-class artists, but you're going to visit merchants that have all sorts of different product lines that they're promoting. So it's really a wonderful space in that regard.
Joseph Vigneri, tell us how long you have had your live model studio there.
I've been doing modeling for about 9 years, but only since COVID hit did I start looking for a studio locally because I needed to have some place where I could do life drawing for the colleges, for Carthage College, for Whitewater College, and do it from a studio on Zoom because for a while you weren't allowed to be face-to-face. Mm. So it started there. I've been there for 3 years. Just a little to add about the Racine Business Center that Robert was talking about, it is the oldest operating business incubator in the United States. This building started being built right after the Civil War in 1865, and it got its success because the railroad tracks in Racine run right by the complex, and they brought trail ends to the yard and ran the rail lines right down along the sides of the businesses. So all through the 1800s and into the last century, any business that wanted to operate could get a space at the Racine Business Center and have their raw materials delivered from anywhere in the world, then make their product and ship it right out of the same door to anywhere in the world because the railroad came up to the doors. As the Racine area developed and the Racine Business Center, being antiquated in a very old building, wasn't really operating at full capacity with businesses, they had the idea to divide it into small studios and rent it out to local artists. And this has been going on for, 28 years now? And I'm only 3 years a part of it, but I love the idea of community. When I do a draw every Tuesday night at my draw, I always make sure that there's a spot in the middle for about 20 or 25 minutes that we stop and we have snacks and we have drinks, because there is something magical about artists rubbing elbows with each other and looking at each other's art and getting inspired. Oh, how do you do that? Oh, what do you use for this technique? Or how do you make that effect on your drawing or on your painting or on your sculpture or on your ceramics or whatever? So the idea of that social minute where the artists are not creating but showing off their creations and meeting each other, that's important. Mm. And it really has a magical feel when the city is showing up in the thousands and all these studios are open and everybody's smiling.
And, of course, you're talking about the big open house that is going to be happening tomorrow. I wanted to ask about the connection that the various artists who have studios there, the connection that you have on an ongoing basis, even beyond a public event like tomorrow. I mean, how much do you bump into each other in the halls or have chance to be connected? Or are these relatively private, insulated studios in which each of you are just kind of doing your own work?
The answer to that is both. They're private studios. You can shut the door and leave the world out. But I was just telling Joseph and Robert that that there are days that I come to work and I'm just work and play, I call it, really. I'm totally determined to get up there and get something done. I know what I'm going to work on that day. And I pass somebody in the hall and they stop to talk to me and I have to kind of calm myself down and realize the whole point of moving out of my home studio into this studio was to make connections with people, because artists are cut off. You know, you're isolated, you're doing your work and it's wonderful, but you know, you're cut off from meeting other people. So I really try to make an effort to talk to everybody I pass in the hallway. But we're not all there at the same time, but we are all there on Saturday, and it's so fun to show up and all the doors are open and all the lights are on, and we're set up to draw people into our studios. I'm just going to give one example and let them talk. But I have something called a long arm quilting machine, which is basically a sewing machine on wheels. And as you wheel it across your fabrics, it sews. So instead of sitting and pushing your fabric through a sewing machine, you're moving the sewing machine across the fabric. So I set up fabric. I stand there for 6 hours, and I have people come in and try it. And that draws them in, because they look in and they think, oh, I don't know if I want to go in there. And then when they see that they can actually play with the machine, we put together a quilt in one day. And then I donate it to Lemon Street, and Lemon Street auctions it off for fundraising for themselves.
Wow. Great idea.
One thing I want to tag on to what Joseph was saying about Draw Joseph, which is a wonderful facility. If people are interested in life drawing, this is the place to go. It is really well designed. Joseph does an incredible job setting it up and making the space available. The other thing, if people want to learn a little bit about the arts, and there's a couple different places, Wisecrack Fiber Arts, and that's Margaret. She teaches also. And then there's Periwinkle Art Studio that also has teaching facilities for people that are interested. So, I mean, it's... You know, we use this term from a historical standpoint, the manufacturing centers. This is really transitioned to the arts now. It's really showcasing some incredibly talented people in painting, sculpture, drawing, ceramics, mixed media, photography, fiber arts, and more.
Mm. For those of you just joining us, we are talking about a big, wonderful event that's going to be happening tomorrow at the 16th Street Art Studios. It's 1405 16th Street in Racine. It's the artistic home to some 90 Racine area artists. And so this open house allows the public to walk in the door and see the whole facility, including just about all of the studios. And it's a wonderful opportunity. We have three of the artists who are housed in those 16th Street studios, Margaret Heller, Robert Mayer, and Joseph Ignieri. And Robert, I don't think we've yet spelled out the hours for tomorrow's open house.
Yes, it's 10 to 4, and there's free parking and free admission.
Very good.
I'm actually in charge of the volunteer court tomorrow, and I've done a very unique thing the first time for our open house. I've opened it up to a local Boy Scout troop. Troop number 142 is coming. There's going to be 15 or 16 scouts in uniform and three leaders, and I have a smattering of other volunteers also, and they'll all be easily identifiable. So when you come to this place, I mean, the building is enormous, and we are on all four floors. So what I'm going to do is actually run pink ribbon down the ceiling of every place where you can walk, where there will be artists, and the Boy Scouts will be all over the building. There'll be greeters at the door. So if you can just come and find some place to park near the building, or actually drive in right into the complex and park in the back. There's lots and lots of parking. Come into the building. Every door will have a greeter. And those scouts are going to bring people up to the art studios and then come back to the door and get some more people and then bring them back up. So find a smiling scout, and you can find your way all over the building, and we'll show you where all the studios are.
Fantastic. I was just realizing that I have not been to an open house at 16th Street since before COVID. So I am way overdue to experience this again. And of course, there's plenty of people who have yet to experience their first open house at 16th Street. And so we hope lots of people listening are going to make a point of stopping by sometime between 10 and 4. I want to get a little bit of background from each of you on your own artistic endeavors. And Margaret, let's begin with you. You are the fiber artist in the room and quilt maker as well. I'm curious to know at what point in your life this particular kind of work became important to you, and what has sort of the shape of your artistic life been over the years?
Back in probably about 1969-70, I was a starving student, and I saw a quilt in a window of a shop that was made of velvet and tapestry, and I fell in love with it. But of course, I was too poor to buy it, so I figured out how to make it, and I went home. And from then on, I have figured out how to make quilts. And some people learned it from their parents or grandparents or something like that, but I was just always figuring it out on my own and got very involved with the modern art quilt movement that started happening in the 80s that appealed to me more than traditional quilts. And so during all that time, I owned my own business. I was a chiropractor. My studio mate is Bethany Wise, so that's why we are Studio Wise Cracks. That's a little pun on my profession. And since I retired, I have gotten into making quilts all the time. I mean, like, there are people that go and they have second homes, and there are people that go hunting, and there are people that have a passion for golf or tennis, and my passion is going to an art studio and working. So it's really play for me to go there, and I really love that I have a studio actually now.
So there are, of course, a lot of different ways to make quilts. I mean, all the way from hand stitching everything to very modern technology. And you even mentioned specifically one bit of technology that is a means to kind of draw people into the studio. How have you done quilts over the years and even now today? I mean, in terms of I'm sure you make a wide variety of quilts, but do you essentially build them in the same way, or do you utilize different sorts of means of construction for different quilts?
Well, I have two tabletop machines, sewing machines, like like everybody else, home domestic machines. And then I have the long arm machine. And the long arm machine is about 8 feet long, and it stretches the fabric. I mean, you can do 8 feet, you could do 2 feet. But it stretches the fabric over the frame, and then you move the sewing machine across it. So that creates the layers. And I do things called, I do regular quilts, and I still do, traditional, but I really like moving into the modern colors and the modern fabrics that people are designing fabric now and selling it. And I just finished a piece in collaboration with Tricia Blasco, and it's called Thread Painting, and she did a print on fabric that's about 6 feet by 4 feet, and I thread painted it, which meant taking my machine and going back and forth until it was colorized, basically. Wow. So I'm all over the board.
Wow. So what, in a sense, guides what you are going to do on a particular day in terms of with a particular quilt? And at the moment, are you working on a quilt or multiple quilts?
I think I have about 12 in process right now. Wow. And what guides it is when I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and I'm thinking, what if I put black next to that orange? That would really make it pop. And so a lot of my inspiration comes at 4 o'clock in the morning, and that that guides what I'm going to be working on that day. But now that I have a studio, I don't get uptight that I have to finish this and put it away or give it away. Because it's going to be in my way. So I just have stuff going on everywhere at home and at my studio.
Now, are you an artist that is a frequent participant in various art fairs? I mean, for instance, are we likely to see your work at those kind of events?
Well, I've kind of gotten into entering my quilts and my fiber art. I've had pieces at the Anderson Center the last couple of years. I didn't really have the courage or the thought process to do that, but there's a group from the studios, the Thursday Morning Coffee Clutch. I don't think they call it clutch. I threw that in. When you get together with them and have coffee, they talk about like what shows are opening up, where you might want to enter things. And that's been really helpful. Otherwise, I was just working at home and giving them away.
Wow.
So I'm really having a good time entering them into shows.
Very good. You mentioned fiber arts, which is obviously, you know, to some extent a close cousin to quilt making, but I assume that term refers to something else that you are creating.
Well, part of the problem with using quilt in a sentence is you will frequently get somebody who responds with, oh, my grandma makes quilts. And that kind of becomes our pet peeve, you know, because you've stereotyped the whole profession when it is so varied. The other thing people will say is, it's so sad that quilting is a dying art, when it's absolutely not. If you know about BC, what's a Rebecca BC? No, she's one of our studio people. The name always escapes me, but there was a huge show at the Museum of Modern Art or in Chicago last year that was astounding. It was overrun with people, and it's fiber arts where she applies layers and layers of fabric in order to get pictures of African-American culture.
Hmm. So there it is, a wide, varied art form, and it sounds like it continues to feed you on a lot of different levels.
I can't. Yeah. And then you've got YouTube. You could spend your whole life going down that rabbit hole of finding out what other people are doing all over the world on YouTube. So, yeah, so many projects.
So your studio is one of the studios that will be part of tomorrow's open house.
Definitely. I can't wait.
Very good, Margaret Heller. Robert Mayer, you are a ceramics artist. And tell us when this first became an important part of your life.
Well, I was extremely fortunate, and there's a situation where a lot of young artists start out this way, where a neighbor or maybe their parents introduce the child to the arts in some form or fashion. Could be crafts, could be any of the things that all of a sudden people enjoyed doing. And that was my situation. I had a neighbor down the street that was always coming up with different ways to entertain us. And one of the things that I just clicked on was ceramic. She had a kiln and a wheel, and I took off with that. And so graduating high school, went on to College University of Wisconsin at Stout and studied art education and taught for a couple of years. And really enjoyed it. Decided to change gears a little bit, and I went to Madison and studied landscape architecture, and I did that for 35 years. And then when I retired, I decided, well, what do I want to do? And it really came down to reaching back into something that I just had the most fun with. And with my wife and I moving from Tennessee back up to Wisconsin, where we actually started out, got to talking to a few people and heard about the 16th Street and wasn't quite sure what that was all about. And turns out that a studio became available, and I was off and running. I built my studio and just have enjoyed the experience and the sense of community. I want to. I know we've talked about that a little bit, but that is such a strong impetus for people to that are in the arts or the creative process to share ideas and kind of cross-pollinate. You know, Joseph used the word incubator from a manufacturing standpoint. That's the same. You could apply that to what we're doing at the 16th Street. It's really an artist's incubator where people are coming together and building on their work and sharing ideas with other people. Hmm.
So if we were to walk into your studio, what would we see? What have you put together in terms of your studio, and what is there that allows you to create your ceramics and pottery?
Well, once you get past the mess, and that's the one thing that I think artists enjoy is the mess. My studio is relatively small. I share it with another artist, Patty Fallon. She's a ceramic artist and also does watercolor. But my studio is basically set up. There's, you know, shelving that showcases my work. There's production sides of it. My work is really focusing on two components of the ceramic process. One is called slip casting, where you have plaster molds and you pour liquid clay into them, and you are able to come take it out after it sets up. And what I do with that is I manipulate it. I change it from its original purpose and I reimagine it, if you will, into something else. And then I have a wheel, a ceramic throwing wheel that I can throw basically anything I want. So there's a combination of wheel throwing and slip casting that creates something that's a little bit out of the ordinary. That's a little bit, I like to use the term whimsy, because that's the thing that I think when someone is looking at a piece of art or crafts or anything, you want that person to engage with that piece. You want them to go ahead and ask themselves a question about, well, what's going on here? Why did the artist do this? And that's the thing that I think is really fun about the artistic process, is just making sure that there is a question, in my regard, Lau, a question is being asked, and you're drawing that person into, and you know, and if you're available, having a dialogue. That's the one great thing about these open houses, is that the public is able to talk to the artists. And yes, we would like to sell some pieces now and then, and that would be a good thing. But it's also important to go ahead and educate the public about, okay, this is what, you know, the process. This is, you know, what I was, you know, going after. This, you know, so that is all a part of this open house experience.
Very good. Has your work changed a lot over the years? I mean, like, if we looked at what you make now versus what you made some years ago, have your ideas evolved or your intentions evolved at all?
That's a great question. You know, as an artist, what we want to do is challenge ourselves at every crossroad. So what I started out doing years ago has definitely changed. And, you know, and I'm playing around with things, trying different things that, you know, they may work out, they may not. So, yes, I mean, that it gets rather dull and boring if you're constantly doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. You really want to go ahead and experience different approaches and coming up with maybe new ideas.
Very good. So Robert Mayer is has a ceramics pottery studio at the 16th Street Art Studios, and will be one of the artists whose studio will be open for visitation tomorrow at the open house 10 to 4. Finally, we turn again to Joseph Vigneri, who has a live model studio at the 16th Street Studios. So, Joseph, I vaguely remember, although it's some years ago now, when live modeling became a part of your life. But I don't remember the start of it. How did this new chapter in your artistic life sort of open up for you?
Very interesting. Well, you know me, Greg, because you're a musical director and you've directed me at the Racine Theater Guild in a number of productions. And the theater really opened up my life and allowed me to experience feelings I'd never felt before. One of the most was self-confidence, because I'd never been self-confident all my life. Now, I am a social worker by trade. I got a degree from Carthage College, and that's where I fell in love with, because I took art as an elective, I fell in love with drawing from the figure. And I would always draw at a draw on Tuesday night in Kenosha at Artworks, and Chet Griffith, who started that draw and would run it, would say to me, "Joseph, you're an actor. You should do this for me. I have a hard time getting male models." And I'd say, "Yeah, but at least when you act, you get to wear a costume."
Right, right.
So I never did it. I took care of my father. He was a quadriplegic, and he passed away in 2015. And I didn't know what I was going to do with my life from then on. But I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get in a play. So I went to Racine Theater Guild, and I got into a play called Calendar Girls. And I played the romantic interest who dies of cancer, and his wife decides to talk all of her friends into not doing quilting and not doing ceramics, but doing life modeling. And it's a true story. It became a sensation. And I was cast in this play, and the call went out from the director, Doug Instness, down at Racine Theater Guild, said, "Hey, cast and crew, we're doing this show. We could make our own calendar." So I went with a lot of my compatriots, and we got our picture taken in the buff at the receipt. It was something strategically placed in front of the Bitty Bits. Mm-hmm. And I brought that calendar down to Chet, and I said, "Chet, would you support the Racine Theater Guild, buy one of these here calendars? Look, I'm in November." And he goes, "Oh, you can pose for the Racine Theater Guild, but you can't pose for my life drawing class." And I said, "Put me on the schedule."
Right.
And I did, and it was a revelation. It was the hardest stage I'd ever been on. I didn't have any script, no costume, no makeup, no character, no movement, just my human body, which I have never had self-confidence in. And suddenly the artists were drawing me, and I looked in their art, and I saw everything that I hated about myself, but it was beautiful because it was seen through the eyes of the artists, who never met the bullies that tortured me when I was in sixth grade.
Right.
And I suddenly was freed from decades of self-condemnation, and I said, "I know what I'm going to do the rest of my life." And so from that day to this, I have posed 1,387 times.
Right. I know you've done quite a lot of that at Carthage and at some other colleges and universities as well. So when you are posing in a session like that, what are the kinds of things you need to do or need to be thinking about in order to be a model that is, in a sense, I guess, useful to the artists who are drawing you? Or is it just a matter of being not self-conscious and just sitting there and being there?
In any type of art, it is the artist with their own talents trying to inspire, if no one else, at least themselves. And they try to take something and form it and create an inspiration. Only in figure art is there a human being on each side of the easel? The person in front of the easel is making themselves vulnerable, is allowing the artist to look and see. This is humanity, not just lines and shapes and shadows, but the very essence, the living breath, the beating heart. The artist, for their part, on the other side of the easel, takes advantage of this rare, extremely wonderful, privileged opportunity to see a human being, and not runway models, but every the guy down the street. I have one of my proteges, Walter. He's a 76-year-old defense attorney. He's not a runway model, but the artists see the life there, and the more intriguing the life, as a matter of fact, the more wrinkles and scars, the better, the more human the person is, the better. And that interaction then creates a piece of art that both people had to show up in order to make.
Wow.
I think it's a marvelous process, and I like to teach modeling, and that's one of the main reasons I have the studio. So when people come to the open house, what I'm doing is introducing them to a place where they could come themselves without even any experience at all, because I've got all the materials, I've got pens and pencils and everything you need, papers, come and draw, and it's free. And if you're interested, if you've ever thought, what would it be like? Could I do it? Could I come out of the robe? Could I let artists look upon me? I teach modeling. I've had 102 proteges. So anytime you come to my studio, you may be meeting a brand new model who is also an artist, who is doing a craft.
That's great. Joseph, I want to talk for just a second about what you mentioned briefly early on, which is that one of the things that prompted you to seek out this studio space on 16th Street was COVID, and the fact that during the worst of the COVID pandemic, it was not possible. I mean, first of all, it wasn't possible for the artists themselves to be in a room and with a live model. So you did managed to continue your work, to an extent at least, via Zoom. I'm just curious what that was like. How different did it feel to be not in the room with those drawing you?
I wanted to continue posing for Carthage, which is my alma mater, and Diane Levesque was the wonderful professor at that time, since retired, but she is one of our members, one of our art studios, so come and see Diane. And Diane wanted to continue having live modeling for her students. The only way to accomplish this, since everything was in shutdown, as a matter of fact, her class was meeting over Zoom, was to have a studio where I could broadcast the posing, and that could then be beamed to all these students in the class. I did it for Carthage, and I also did it for Whitewater. At the time, you weren't allowed to be in the room with anybody. Everybody was isolated and separated in the world. And what is life modeling? Life modeling is coming to a room, coming out of your robe, holding completely still in front of a whole group of artists who are all aimed directly at you, as close as they can get, who are breathing for 3 hours in the room. There's no way to do it. So having the studio was essential. And in the process, I created a dais with an air filtration system, and it's still in operation. So when you come to the studio, you will be breathing purified, clean air. And I think it's important, though, that you are in the room, because when I did the Zoom classes, I did it for about 18 months, and when I did them, you're just in a quiet, empty room in front of a camera. And when you're in the room with the artists, you hear the scratches, you hear their sighs of accomplishment when they get something just right, or their little moans of frustration when a line is wrong and they have to correct something, and you get to walk over and look over their shoulder. There's something about that. Together we were creating this art that it only happens if the artist is in the room.
So I think this is true of a whole lot of us in a whole lot of different endeavors. COVID and the way you did live modeling during COVID really deepened your appreciation for why this was important to you and why you loved it so much.
Yes, so it saved the craft, yes.
Yeah, very good. So Joseph Ignieri has his live modeling studio at 16th Street, and that will be yet another studio that will be open for tomorrow's open house. Robert Mayer, how many of the many, many studios there do you suspect will be open at tomorrow's open house?
It's a good question. We typically will have probably in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 studios that will be open, and along with the merchants that are within our building. So, the response from our studios has been better and better each year because people understand the value in reaching out to the community. So, yeah, it's a growing endeavor.
Very good. So remind our listeners again of exactly when the open house is and exactly where the 16th Street Art Studios are located.
Yeah, it's going to be this spring open house is this Saturday from
so
10
tomorrow.
To 4.
Mm-hmm.
And tomorrow, yes. And the address is 1405 16th Street. Plenty of parking. Free to the public. And as Margaret mentioned earlier, we have two a year. The spring one is the last Saturday in April, and the winter one is the first Saturday in December. And we really are looking forward to the community coming out.
Fantastic.
I'd like to add that we do have elevators, and there are people that man the elevators to make sure that because these are freight elevators. And the important thing is if you have a hard time getting around, you're not going to cover the 60,000 square feet or whatever. But if you just got to the third floor, you would be able to see maybe 20, 25 artists.
Wow.
So you don't have to cover all the ground. And if you have a problem getting around, there are ways to do this. And so don't be afraid to come by.
I'm so glad you said that. Margaret Heller, Robert Mayer, Joseph Ignieri, three of the artists who do their work at the 16th Street Art Studios at 1405 16th Street in Racine. And again, that open house is tomorrow from 10 to 4. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on the morning show to spread the good word about this really interesting event. We hope lots of people will seek it out and enjoy all there is to see and experience there. And thank you again for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Part two is coming up in just a moment. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. And now an interview from the Morning Show archives.
Well, I count as a real pleasure the chance to have spoken to best-selling novelist Jodi Picou about her book, The Tenth Circle. And we talk with her again, this time about her newest novel, which is every bit as good, called 19 Minutes. First of all, Jodi Picou, welcome back to the Morning Show.
Thank you.
It just seems to get better and better for you. This is quite a hot streak you're on.
I know. Very lucky.
Very good. This is an interesting book, and it has quite a trauma at the heart of it, a trauma that I'm not sure you want us to talk about. But one of the things that you do so well is write so authentically about young people, high school young people caught up in something really, really terrifying and awful. Just tell us what it was like for you to write about something like this and how you've managed to give such authentic voice to these young people.
Well, I think that, you know, the reason I wrote this book, which we can say it is about a school shooting, is because I really wanted to examine why I can remember being bullied in school and my children, all these years later, are still being bullied in schools and surviving it. You know, why is this an epidemic? Why is it not addressed? Why do people feel that bullying is just part of growing up? Why does it have to be? And I think that's a very naive view. I think a lot of administrations, school administrations, want to put their head in the sand and say, oh, yes, we have an anti-bullying policy in place, but it's never really put into practice. And that was really what I wanted to visit when I wrote the book. It was very, very hard to write because I do have children, and they do go through this every now and then during school, in their school careers. You know, as they've gotten older, they've learned to deal. They've found coping mechanisms, as many kids do, but not all kids do, and that was why I wrote this book. There are some kids who, in adolescence, don't fit in or can't fit in, and because of that, they become a moving target for 4 years. I wanted to write a book for all of them.
How did you manage, let me just kind of reiterate the heart of the question, which is, how did you manage to write so authentically in their voice? I mean, I feel like we're really listening to real young people spilling their guts, unburdening their hurts, that sort of thing. Does it just come from having some young people in your life? Surely it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of it is I do have my own study group living under my roof, you know, and I have two teenagers and I can listen to them and the things that they say. But, you know, I do something pretty radical when I write about teenagers. I actually talk to them. And I sit down with them. I ask them what they're thinking about, what they fear. I listen to how they talk, the rhythms of their speech. They become research for me like any other research. And it's really by listening to what they have to say that I sometimes realize what I need to be writing about.
Mm. One of the young people, one of the principal characters, is battling depression. And as you write about that, we think sadly of all the young people who not only are suffering from depression but are harboring that as a secret and
right.
Not getting the help they need.
Yeah, and I have written a book about teen suicide already and interviewed many suicidal teens. Very interestingly, a lot of school shooters, they say that the line between a mass murder and a suicide is actually very thin. And many of these shooters who go into a school with a gun are planning on killing themselves and just at the last minute say, oh, well, I'll take other people along with me, you know, which is very, very sad. One of the probably the most important voices that I spoke to was during my research, and it was a young man who was the survivor of a school shooting in 2003 at Rocori High School in Minnesota. And his best friend was killed that day, and he was in the gym class where the other victim was killed. A lot of his fears, his comments, and his impressions of the event and how it's continued to affect him years later really became the heart of the book for me.
Mm. Another theme in the book, among several, is that of teenage romance, and particularly teenage romance that doesn't quite work out well. I suppose that can really be a rich field to plow when you're a novelist.
Yeah, it's you know, it is. It's a very interesting, and it's touched upon. It is not in particular gone into with great depth. That's the whole book by itself. But in particular, it's about abusive relationships. And there's a lot of that going on in high schools as well, but I think people don't realize. They say that one out of every three romantic relationships in high school is abusive. And of course, the relationship that I write about in this book not only shows you another facet of bullying. You can be bullied within a relationship, but sometimes how girls lose themselves all in the process of trying to fit in because their identity is wrapped up in who they're with, not
exactly.
Who they are.
Exactly, and what a disturbing thing that can certainly be.
Exactly.
Hmm. The title is so intriguing, and I think your book especially lives up to that old adage that one of the best things you can do to write a great book is write a great beginning. And your opening paragraph is so intriguing in talking about what can happen in 19 minutes. Where did you get that idea?
Well, you know, 19 is just one of my favorite numbers, which is why I picked that one. But for me, I wanted to create a sense of calm, of ordinariness, and that little paragraph that starts the book, which starts off by saying, you know, in 19 minutes you can color your hair, you can get a tooth filled by a dentist, you can fold laundry for a family of five, and it ends with you can change the world or you can just jump off it, and then it says, in 19 minutes you can get revenge. And I wanted you to feel as if suddenly in the middle of this totally bucolic little paragraph, everything had changed. Mm. And in a way, the first chapter after that does the same thing. It's a very ordinary day. Nothing is different than it ever is. And then suddenly, the whole world stops.
Right. And that's, of course, how something like a school shooting, that's exactly...
That's how it occurs, yeah.
Yeah, it bursts into this idyllic
right.
Setting. The book is absolutely wonderful. I just wanted to allow you to make brief mention of another project you have, which is going to work for DC Comics for Wonder Woman.
Yes.
Your last book, of course, included the really intriguing presence of graphic novels, and here you are undertaking something very different. What's that experience been like?
It's been a really, really steep learning curve because when you write a novel, you have all the space in the world, and when you write a comic, you have 22 pages. But I was asked by DC Comics basically if I would be interested in writing Wonder Woman because of the graphic novel that they saw in my last book. And I really, you know, I kept thinking I don't have time for this, but my children convinced me that I really had to do it. And it's really been fun. It is such an honor to be part of such a cultural icon's history. I'm only the second woman in the history of the comic book character since the 1940s to write her.
Wow, very
good. Yeah, I know. So that's been really, it's been really great. The first issue hits on March 28th, and I think people will be pretty impressed with where her character goes.
Very good. Jodi Picou, I loved your book, 19 Minutes, published
thank
by
you.
Atria, and best wishes with all your future writing.
Thanks so much.
It is 9 o'clock. This is WGTD HD.